From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made just a few days ago when Congressman Chris Collins announced his resignation, pleading guilty in an insider trading case. Federal investigators had alleged that Collins used his knowledge as a company board member to make money and avoid significant losses before the public had a chance to digest information about that company. Collins is alleged to have also alerted family members to sell their stock and get out and save money as well. And for months, Collins said he was being railroaded, he was innocent, he looked forward to proving it in court. And he narrowly won re-election despite the indictment last year. Well, this week, Collins admitted he had been lying all along. He's guilty. He's resigning. He joins the sad and growing list of Western New York members of Congress to go down in scandal. Eric Massa, Chris Lee, Chris Collins. Who have I forgotten? Governor Andrew Cuomo will call for a special election, and he's hinted that it could come in April. Meanwhile, Republicans are already saying that they are ready to move forward, free from the cloud that Collins cast. Democrats are turning to Nate McMurray for a second run at that seat. This hour, a conversation about the impact of scandal and corruption on voter trust. It's about a district, but it's really about where we are in terms of voters who do or do not trust the process of politics in general. And let's have a conversation about that. In studio, we have Mark Cassini, the CAO at American Rock Salt, former Gatestown supervisor and former congressional candidate himself. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Evan, great to see you. Glad to be on.
Also with us is Jen Lunsford, who's an attorney with Seeger and Shortino and a former candidate for the 55th Senate District, running again in a year. So that election is more than a year away, and that is not the district we're talking about today. But welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line with us is Tim Nealon, chair and professor in the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. Tim, welcome back. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me, Evan.
Tim, professor, did I miss any scandals there? I tried to remember the recent list.
Yeah, no, I mean, you got all the recent representatives. Let's not even get into what's going on in Albany.
Well, Albany has its own list, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to start here in studio and just ask both of our guests this. And I'll be specific. Mark, I'll start with you. On the Republican side, they've said, look, this is a chance to move forward. There's a lot of potential faces and names who could run for the seat, that there's a lot of confidence in the pool of candidates. Can you move forward quickly? Is there a shadow that Collins cast, or is that over now?
No, of course there's a shadow. It comes to voter trust. You know, I'll quote a Pew Research Center poll that I have in front of me right now, and there is no mystery to the fact that we have low voter turnout, and when you compare to other countries, we're among the lowest. Why is that? When these scandals occur, people are turned off. They don't trust the electoral process because the people they elect betray them, and that has a direct result on voter turnout and voter participation in elections. There's no question about it, and this is going to be no exception.
What should the Republican Party do now moving forward?
Well, I don't think it's the Republican Party. I think the governor needs to push for a very quick election. That's first of all.
What's quick, though? Because let me go ahead and read what the governor told WBFO yesterday.
Do it till January.
Well, no, I think he's saying, well, here's what the governor said to WBFO yesterday. Quote, the next scheduled election is at the end of April, and there's a benefit to doing it on a scheduled election date because then you don't have to hold a special election just for one office. You don't have to have the Board of Elections do the paperwork. People don't have to come out just for one seat. Sounds like he's leaning toward April. Would that be not soon enough for you?
No, as soon as you can. I think the soonest date is January. They could do this. And quite frankly, and not to stir any trouble or controversy, but it's kind of interesting to hear the governor worried about money when he's spending hundreds of millions and billions on projects that are failing. But in the case of having somebody elect or to represent the district in an election, something very critical and important for those people, he's not willing to put up the pennies that it would be associated with that versus the hundreds of millions and billions that have been wasted on projects that have failed. I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me.
So you're saying don't wait till April?
No.
Okay.
No.
Jen Lunsford, let's start there, and then we'll work in a different direction. But when should this election happen? Is April okay with you?
April's okay with me because the realities of having to orchestrate an election are very complicated. You have to have election inspectors and polling locations, and those are hard to put together. Right now, we're struggling, even here in Monroe County, to staff our early polling locations. Because of the accelerated primary schedule with the state and congressional candidates, ballot petitioning is going to be going on in January and February. And there's just a lot for the Board of Elections to do. I think in terms of physical manpower, April just makes the most sense for the human capital involved.
Okay. And it looks like the Democrats are going to be confident with Nate McMurray once again. As a Democrat, not necessarily living in that district, but being very involved in politics locally, what do you think Democrats need to do going forward?
I think we need to continue the same thing we've been doing, which is speaking truth to power. Nate has been a very strong advocate for stronger laws to rein in this kind of corruption. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, even when I was knocking doors in 2018, as soon as Representative Collins was indicted, I started hearing more about corruption at the doors. People, politicos, think that corruption isn't a kitchen table issue, but it is now, because we look at Washington every day and we are seeing corruption out in the open. I think part of the reason some people aren't taking what's happening in the White House as seriously is because it is all out in the open. We think if it's a real crime, you're going to be secretive about it. But we've got not just our president, but members of the cabinet, members of Congress, openly committing crimes every day. And it's, forget eroding confidence in the electoral system, it's eroding confidence in our government.
So, Tim Nealon, when it comes to how quickly we need to have this this election filled, let's start there with you. Is April logical, or do you agree with Mark that it ought to be ASAP?
I would like to see it sooner. And I actually am a little concerned in some ways because, of course, that is the date of the presidential primary. Exactly. But it is unlikely that there'll be a Republican primary. So it's a terrific day to bring Democrats out who will no doubt be enthused. I think that actually could help Nate McMurray a little bit. So having it on a different date might actually create a more interesting election for the GOP, at least. So that I would say sooner rather than later. Fill that seat. Good heavens, it's 13 months to the next general election. I would be actually agree with Hassini on that one.
Now,
hugs and kisses.
now when Mark, Tim, when Mark kind of frames it this way, that voter turnout is low because people don't trust. I think what Mark's really saying is that people just assume that corruption is so common that they're exhausted by it. And interestingly enough, it was Matthew Iglesias writing for Vox recently in regards to the impeachment proceedings, that in which he made kind of a similar point here. What he's, and I do not want to get derailed by the Bidens, Ukraine, etc., but here's Iglesias's point. What he believes what Donald Trump did is obviously illegal and impeachable. However, he also says you cannot look at what the Bidens did and think, well, that should be normal, because at the very minimum, it's using family connections to make boatloads of money, even if it's legal. And if it's legal, it's legal. But is that ethical? And Iglesias's point is that voters are so numb to that now that he thinks it helps the president. He thinks it helps those in the White House. And he goes on to basically say that when voters decide that, well, go ahead and investigate wrongdoing, you're going to find it everywhere. So what if our guy does it? So what if it's a little worse? It's everybody. There's a numbness there. That's what Mark is saying here, Tim. Do you think there's a numbness among the electorate about corruption?
I think, sadly, there is. I think just you have these constant headlines about corruption after corruption in politics. And, of course, you do have more narrow casting in terms of who's reading what. So, you know, I suppose Fox News is probably highlighting Joe Biden's corruption. And, of course, the New York Times is framing up Trump's corruption. So all of this has a tendency to both exhaust maybe the independent voter, but I think partisans are just going to simply ignore, as they usually do, news that they disagree with, that doesn't fit in with their already constructed narrative about their political party or their candidate. So they'll just go on, but they'll think that the other person is corrupt. I do think, sadly, as Iglesias says, that the way that the coverage of Donald Trump is, this impeachment process, it's almost normal, right? It almost becomes, okay, well, another Trump investigation and impeachment. I do think it exhausts the voters, and I actually think it hurts the ability to clean politics up. And I would like to see more issues like Collins. I mean, I really hope in some ways that there'll be some sort of justice for a guy who held on to his seat, maybe, we suspect, so he could have a bargaining chip when it came to his own conviction and sentencing, you know, kind of like what Elliot Spitzer did. And that's just unjust for the 27th district and all those voters that live there who now lack representation going forward.
Well, if I could jump
ahead,
in,
Mark. Yeah,
many, many months ago when this broke, I'm a Twitter nut, unfortunately, for good or bad. I tweeted out that he should resign for that very reason. I couldn't agree with you more.
Where were your fellow Republicans on that?
I don't know. But
is that a fair question?
It is a fair question because, quite frankly, it was disgusting the fact that he stayed in. It was clear that he would not be effective. It was wrong. It was unfair to the voters of the district. And I thought he should just resign, period.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because you were strongly making your opinions known about that, Mark, and yet party chairs, people close to Chris Collins, especially in Buffalo, were going, well, let's wait and see. We think he can still win, or he says he's innocent. I mean, I try to be fair here. Every observer I talked to with expertise in insider trading said, this not only looks like insider trading, this looks like a ham-fisted Keystone Cops version of insider trading.
I didn't care if he could win or not. I thought it was disgusting that he would represent our party. I know people say, well, innocent until proven guilty, but clearly, the handwriting was on the wall and he was ineffective as a congressman. Even if he beat this rap, he was tied up day to day fighting this. So I'm jumping in, Jen. I apologize. I'm monopolizing.
Jen's probably not disagreeing with a whole lot of you here, Mark. And to cross the divide, that's what we do on Connections. Mm-hmm. We've got a Democrat and a Republican agreeing on a lot of this. But before I turn back to Jen on this, Mark, if Democrats and if Nate McMurray win this seat, what they are going to say is, this is a time where we need a fresh start in this district that has been so beset by corruption, and this party had its chance, and you stood with that guy, and you don't get a second chance right now because people are sick of it. And if Nate McMurray wins, do you think Republicans will have themselves to blame?
Well, sure, in part. This is a Republican district, and if he wins, it's clearly because in this case, we had a corrupt congressman who continued to represent the district when he should have put the best interests of the voters ahead of his own interest and stepped down. And you can't blame voters for being upset with that. But it's too bad, you know. And I look at some of the congressmen that we have had step down, and we talked about Chris Lee. And I was talking to Jen a little earlier. I still can't understand what he would... The guy was posing in the mirror, hitting on somebody as a married man with a kid with no shirt on, telling that person.
I had tried to forget that.
I'm a lobbyist. My name is, you ready? Here's his anonymous name, Chris Lee. I look at this stuff and it's not funny, but part of me kind of chuckles and goes, what are these people thinking? What are you thinking? Or whether it's Eric Massa, Tickle Me Massa, you know, anyways.
Yeah. It's hubris. All of this is hubris. I mean, let's take a look at what Chris Collins did. Chris Collins is indicted under a law that was written because what Chris Collins was doing wasn't illegal. Louise Slaughter wrote a law to address the thing Chris Collins was doing. And then after it passed, he kept doing the thing. Because that's how cocky he was about it. That's what we're seeing from the top down. People who think that they can get away with anything, that they literally don't even care if they get caught. They think they're going to beat the rat. They all think they're Teflon. And that's really the issue. It's the hubris of it, where we have gotten so accepting of corruption that people from the White House to town boards think that there are no consequences for their behavior.
I don't know if there are any possible candidates in the GOP pool who called for Collins' resignation. I don't know offhand.
Not unelected that I can think of.
You don't think so? Do you? I mean, I suspect, Jen, you find that disqualifying.
I do. I think that even silence is complicity in this situation. There were many opportunities to address what he was doing, to at least suggest that somebody who is currently being indicted, again, under a law written for them.
Well, before I grab our first phone call, and we do want to hear from listeners on this, as we're talking about not only Chris Collins, but also corruption, the impact of corruption on voter trust, and what major parties can do, what candidates can do, what we ought to expect out of our system. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. It's connections@WXXI.org if you want to email us. You know, Mark, you're right. You called for a resignation despite being a Republican, despite wanting to see conservative principles upheld and championed in Washington. Now, if you lived in that district, if the person the GOP nominates did not also call for Collins' resignation and stood by him, would you vote for that person?
I certainly would put that in my consideration, yes. Absolutely, I would consider it. I'd have to look at the person's qualifications, what they bring to the district. I wouldn't completely disqualify somebody. I'd look at what their qualifications were, but it certainly would be something in the back of my head when I would decide.
Okay, interesting. Jane calling to us from Lima. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, I'm very much interested in whether this is a fair game question, because we have a county, we have two county court judge seats up this year due to aging out for the two sitting county court judges. And both of the Republican candidates stood up for Chris Collins last year, and both of them stated that he needed to be reelected in order to keep the district red. And I want to know if you think it's fair for us to question that commitment to the party over the legalities or the rule of law for people that are theoretically going to be sitting for county court judge. And by the way, I'm a Democrat, and we've got two great Democratic candidates who are running. So, yeah.
Well, so I'm not aware, you know, of the statements of every person running, and certainly on the judicial side. But do you feel, Jane, that the judgeships have become too political or too partisan, I guess?
It's beginning to sound that way. If people who are running for judge can say that the district should stay red so that Nancy Pelosi isn't in charge of the House of Representatives, and that's on record. We've got that. I can send you the link.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. Did they say it as a candidate or as a citizen? There's a difference.
Jane?
I haven't heard them say it since they became candidates.
Okay.
Well, I'll say this. The reality is that for better or worse, we run judges on political parties. I have a lot of opinions about that. That's for a different show.
And you're an attorney.
I am an attorney.
Are you uncomfortable with that?
I don't like the politicization of judicial seats. I've also sat on the Judicial Evaluation Committee for local bar associations. Again, separate show. I can talk about this for hours. But I think anytime someone running for a judicial seat expresses an opinion about anything, it can be used to color how you feel they would handle situations in front of them. And if you believe they're putting their party before the interests of the people they would represent, that can translate to how they might handle a case that's in front of them.
No, that's interesting. And briefly, Mark Cassini, when you say there's a difference between a civilian comment and a candidate's comment, you're not saying that if you're in office, you can put on your civilian clothes and say whatever you want. You're saying, did they make this before they were running?
Correct.
Okay. Just want to make sure that distinction. And I agree that I think it matters. I mean, everybody has said things before they might have been running for office. But Tim Neeland, do you think American voters' sort of lack of trust in politics extends to the judicial realm? Does it feel strange that judges run on party lines and sort of have to raise money in the same way that a lot of candidates do? What do you make of that, Tim?
Yeah, that's from the Jacksonian era when we wanted to have democracy so prevalent that we decided to make elective offices out of everything in America, from judges down to things like dog catchers, right? So that's democracy. And so, yes, the political parties have sort of invaded that space. But typically, you know, if you've been a judge and wear a robe, man, you're very likely to get elected, irrespective of your background. I would say something, though, on the corruption. Look, I think you're expecting the voters to be a little naive. I think a lot of voters who voted in that election knew Chris Collins stank. You know, his persona was never, shall we say, you know, warm and friendly.
Amen.
And I think they said they preferred, because of policy, maybe a slightly dirty Republican over a cleaner Democrat. And I know that I don't think that's so cynical, because I think it says that the voters made a choice that they want good candidates. But if they don't have good candidates, they will make a selection based upon the two options they have before them, or three options. There were three candidates. There was an independent candidate in that race that took 5,000 votes. So, I think let's understand that the voters are probably aware, and some of them may have thought he was innocent, and others probably just assumed he wasn't and went ahead and voted for him anyway.
Well, I want to direct our listeners, if you've got time, there's a piece in the New York Times from Ross Douthat recently, and Ross Douthat is a conservative columnist on the opinion page. It to my reading, it is one of the finest pieces of political analysis I have ever seen of the current sort of American moment and the American system. And what Douthat is saying is that a lot of what we've been talking about is sort of propped up by a system. That you have this revolving door, that you get into politics, you can use the influence when you're in office. Obviously, this president is very happy to use it right now, but you can use it when you're out of office. You can move into lobbying. You can move from politics to lobbying back into politics. You can move from politics to the energy sector or many other sectors and right back into politics. You can go into that sector. You can write laws while you're in that sector. You can come back in. Everything gets crossed so quickly, and there's so much money and influence and power peddling that the American voters are so weary. And that Douthat basically concludes that some of what got Trump elected is this idea that everyone sort of sucks. And so does this guy. But whatever. So do all of you. And I'm paraphrasing.
That's dead on. I think so many people think that he is just saying the quiet part out loud. He is just doing out in front of us what everyone does behind the scenes. And that's not true. And I think he's finding that now, where he thought he could walk in and he could run this like a Manhattan real estate operation. And when he realized that there was oversight and there were people looking at what he was doing and he had to keep all his notes, the rubber met the road and he went, uh-oh.
But you think the general sort of framing that Douthat makes there, because what he concludes is Trump is banking on voters saying, hey, that guy just went in there to clean up the mess. And even if he's a little corrupt, he's going after people who are even more corrupt. And that's what he's doing with Biden. But Douthat says, look, he had Paul Manafort running his campaign. That guy propped up dictators. That guy would work with anybody who would pay him. And when you hire that guy from the jump, what you're saying is, I'm not serious about this corruption thing. And the question is, does that play anymore in an election? Well, you know, Mark Cassini, are people so jaded that they just want to break a system? Or do you think that we can restore trust in terms of corruption, especially at the national level?
Well, unfortunately, the old adage, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better, is true. We're going to have to root out the best we can, as much as we can, corruption in the system. There's still a lot. There's still a lot in New York, at the congressional level, all over the place. So unfortunately, this is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. But people are somewhat numb to it right now, and they're skeptical on whether it ever changes. Hmm. I mean, you hear the pay-to-play scenario, and whether it's at the federal level or at the state level, it is all over. It's in front of us. It's actually flaunted, and it just continues on and on. And, you know, the voters, including myself, get very frustrated and say, when's this ever going to change?
Do you think that voters, you talk to a lot of voters, Jen, do you think that they feel that exactly the way that Mark is describing, that sort of exasperation that we are never going to change this is setting in?
Well, I think it's hard to cast all voters with the same, you know, to paint them all with the same brush, because I know that I ran and lots of people supported me and lots of people went out to vote for the first time in 2018. People were telling me they'd never voted in a midterm election. They'd never voted for local candidates because they felt a hope for change. They felt like, oh, well, maybe if I get involved now, maybe I can move the needle. And that comes from a positive place. But then you look at what I call these horseshoe voters, these people who were Bernie supporters. And then when Hillary won the election, they voted for Trump, which is, like, you know, from a policy point of view, very confusing, but not from a burn it down point of view. People who wanted to break the wheel voted for the candidate they thought could break the wheel.
Yeah. We saw that in, of all places. So I'll give you an example. West Virginia. That's where I took my first job out of college. And I worked as a reporter investigating a number of issues, including the way the DEP there, that's their DEC, the Department of Environmental Protection, which is usually staffed by former coal industry executives, draws up the permits for where companies can mine and what the rules are for mining safety. And Don Blankenship was the CEO of Massey Energy at the time. And you know, I don't want to be unkind here, but Don is viewed as sort of a cartoonish cartoon, kind of like a cartoon villain in that state. He has a home atop a mountain that he gets to via a private helicopter, and he looks down at the world, and he's got all the money in the world, and he did not like the piece that we did. But I knew him through that sort of way. And Tim Neeland, I looked as Don Blankenship ran for federal office in West Virginia. He ran overtly racist ads, and I'm not trying to laugh at this, it was serious, but one of the national networks interviewed a voter who had a Blankenship yard sign, and he said, you know what? Everybody's corrupt, and he's our corrupt guy. If everybody's going to be corrupt, we might as well know him. And, you know, and he's corrupt, but so is everybody. Just says it straight out like that. And that, to me, Tim Neeland, when I saw that interview, I thought, boy, we have really passed some sort of a Rubicon here. We are moving in a very cynical direction with politics, and this can't end well. Is that too cynical, Tim?
I don't think it's too cynical at all. I think we've certainly nationalized our elections to the point where it's almost like a tug of war. And as you've said, I mean, you know, research has found this incredible division in this country between Democrats, Republicans, and it's only growing. And again, I think that statement, that comment, that attitude is just prevalent. And it is turning off those people that might have been independent and the people that are surging into these non-parties. I mean, the two major parties are not growing as fast as blanks or other, right, in terms of the number of people deciding who want to register to vote but don't want to be a Democrat or Republican. And I think that is one symptom of this attempt to escape from this corruption that people see in politics. Maybe find a third way, find another candidate. The problem is when it comes to elections, the way that our state laws and other things are stacked by officials from both political parties, major political parties, they tend to support those people who run on the major party line. And then we have our fusion parties that seem to nominate the candidates anyway, the Conservative Party, the Working Families Party, and some of these others, where you've got the major party candidates who seek these lines as well. So you really don't get much of a choice. Green Party may be the one option that things are really quite different there usually.
Marcusini, are you done running for Congress, or could you do it again? Could you run again?
I'm pretty happy where I'm right now, to be honest. I enjoy the private sector. So you won't see me running next year. No.
Not next year?
No. Someday?
Could you run again?
Right now, the answer is no, but I hate saying never, because you just never know.
No, that's fair. And I want to ask both Mark and Jen, a Republican and a Democrat, both who have run races, and both who are still viewed, whether Mark likes it or not, and Jen certainly, as possible future standard bearers for their parties in different ways locally. To my knowledge, you both work your own jobs as well, CAO of American Rock Salt, you're an attorney with Seeger Sorrentino. You don't have your own corruption scandals. My father, who I grew up idolizing, I used to say, Dad, you should run for office. And he used to say, well, two things happen when idealistic people get into politics. They get beaten down and quit, or they become what they despise. And I said, that's really cynical. And he said, I wish it were cynical. It's just realistic. You know, Mark, you have lost congressional races. You have won other races. How have you resisted any temptations that are available to the spoils of office? And I'm serious when I ask this, because, you know, we respect you. We respect Jen. But how strong is that pull for the result to be what my father, a small C conservative, always said was, that's why I didn't run?
Well, there are a lot of temptations, and they are put in front of you. I don't want to go through the litany here at risk of alienating some people that would never talk to me again.
No, name names. Let's do this.
No, for the love of God, no. But I'll tell you that I couldn't sleep at night for me. It's not that important to me. I can do other things in my life. I did it because I cared. I left a great job to go run the town of Gates because I grew up there. I was proud of my town. I wanted to give back. My kids were all grown. It was, I don't want to make it sound like some great sacrifice on my part, although I gave up a lot of money to do it. I did it because I loved my community. You'd have to ask my residents. I think I did some good things for the town, built a library, opened a rec center, all that. But I don't want to give you my resume. The point is that you have to go into it because you want to truly serve people, not to be served, but to serve people and to do good. And if you start finding yourself straying from that theme, you got a problem. You're in it for the wrong reason. And I also think term limits are important for a lot of reasons. But for the most important is that you need to, at some point, step away and let other people with fresh thoughts, ideas, and a clean slate come in and do some good things, too. So,
how many buildings is your name on?
I didn't want it to be on any, but they put my name.
Sometimes they insist. I know some politicians who say, you can have this money if you put my name on the bill.
I told folks, jokingly, because a couple of supervisors have this named after them and that named after them, I said, when I'm dead, you can do whatever you want, because I don't care. But until that point, don't ever do anything with my name on it. But they did surprise me at my retirement, and they put the name on the conference room in the library in big flipping letters, and I had no idea it was coming. So when they did this little goodbye party and retirement party at the town, they pulled off the sheet, and there's my big name, and I went, oh, my God, am I dead? I checked my pulse.
You're still here.
The local undertaker, the DiPanzio Funeral Home, he was there, Chris DiPanzio. I wasn't sure if this was it or not, but, again, I checked my pulse, and all was good. Anyways.
Jen, when you think about, you know, that sentiment about politics, that idealistic people just don't survive, that they either change or they leave— if you consider yourself an idealist, are you worried about what becomes of you if you win a race?
Every day. Every single day. I was really shocked, I think, coming into this, how very quickly, even last year when people were acting like I couldn't win, and I could still feel them trying to use me as a pawn. And that was from outside of politics and inside of politics. And as someone who is a bit of a goody-two-shoes, and I think very much like Mark here, driven to service, not driven for power, not driven to put it on my resume or use it as a stepping stone. I'm driven to make positive change for my community, and that's what draws me to politics. We are the kind of people that get beaten out of it. And I talk to other people who are like-minded, like Matt Brown in Fairport. I talk to all the time about this because we are goody-two-shoes who ran for public office to be better people and make the world nice for our children. And you need to surround yourself with those people because you need to lean on each other when it gets hard. And you need someone in your life to remind you why you were doing this, because it's not enough to have a shiny, bright attitude, and it's not enough to have good policy ideas. You have to be strong enough to not get eaten by the fire. People would say to me, why are you running for this giant mess of a Senate? And I said, because if people like me don't run, no one cleans it up. And we just need a critical mass of people to make the change.
But you know what some people say? They'll get into office and they'll say, well, I can't change everything about the world in the way I wanted to. But on the way out the door, I can cash a check here. Mm-hmm. I can get a family member a job. I can do something for myself. And it's not necessarily even illegal. Mm-hmm. Do you go into office thinking to yourself, my standards are so high that that wouldn't even happen to me?
I personally feel very strongly about using political office to help the people around me. That makes me uncomfortable. So I think that would be a sleeping at night problem for me. But it's funny because I have friends who are lobbyists. I have friends who are, and lobbyists, like people think they're like big, evil, you know, cigar smoking Pfizer like kind of lobbyists. I have friends who are lobbyists for like green energy and, you know, children, like people who like they draft legislation because they're experts in those areas. And if you're leaving government and you are an expert in a thing, I don't think you should necessarily be barred from using that expertise to continue making change. But when you're exchanging
that, I know there's
that,
gray area.
Yeah. When you're exchanging it for enormous checks, that's the problem. And we run into constitutional problems with saying you're not allowed to use your voice and make money because we have a First Amendment. You know, they're it gets hard to, you can't just legislate those things away because of the nature of our system. But I think we can limit how much money can go into politics. I think money is the problem more than terms. Because I sit here running for a seat that is a two-year cycle. There's never a time I'm not running for office. I tucked and rolled through Thanksgiving and kept running. You know, I have to keep trying to raise money. When would I be governing? If I'm sitting in office right now, there's no governing time. You're constantly campaigning. If anything, make the terms longer. give some people some breathing room to do their job.
With maybe term limits?
With maybe term limits. But you got to, people can't, I don't know how anybody does it.
You're saying 2-year terms for any real level of government are unrealistic because it makes it a constant campaign.
It's a constant campaign.
Do you agree, Marcassini?
I would be willing to compromise on that if you wanted some help with campaign finance reform. I agree with you on that. So we could term limits. You could help me, and campaign finance, I'd help you. Maybe we can get something done.
This is where it happens on Connections. Yeah. You hear that? Tim Neelan, is 2 years too short? Does that make it a forever campaign?
Look, we got senators in there for 6 years, and they're spending every week raising money for their next election. So I don't think you're going to stop that constant fundraising, no matter how long. It's just going to up the amount of money you need, $1 million or, $600,000.
Fair, but Jen, you're saying that when you know that next election is basically, within 24 months and the clock counting down, even though you may have to always raise money, does that change your mindset?
I think it does. You see people sending out their first fundraiser for the next cycle in December, right after the election, because they got to post for January. And the reality is, we got to post for January, we got to post for July, and then in the year you're running, you're posting even more. And if you're not posting enough, you're not considered viable, and then the people who have the money won't give you the money because you're not viable. And it's, you need money to make money. It's all so money-centric. And if we keep making our campaigns about who can raise the most money, it's not even about spending the money. It's who can raise the most money. That becomes the benchmark of whether you are a viable candidate. That's not the way to pick someone to represent the interests of the people.
Right. Go ahead briefly, Mark, and then we got to get our only break and we'll get to some phone calls.
Two things. I do think we need campaign finance reform. I'm going to break a little news. I would actually be willing to look at public finance campaigns to get the dirty money out of campaigns.
You're a Republican.
Yeah, it's really bad.
It's really bad. It's got to happen.
Oh, yeah, it is terrible. The other is that term limits are important for a different reason, but I think if you want to clean things up, you have to do campaign finance reform, and you have to put term limits on people that run.
All right, so let's get our only break of the hour, and we're back to your phone calls as we talk about corruption in government. We talk about different ideas on how to change that, restoring voter trust. It's all in the wake of the resignation of Congressman Chris Collins. You just heard Marcassini, who's the CAO of American Rock Salt and a former Gatestown supervisor and a former congressional candidate. Jen Lunsford, an attorney with Seeger Sorrentino and a former candidate and a current candidate in the 55th Senate District in New York State. Tim Neelan's on the line with us, chairperson and professor in the Department of History and Political Science at Nazareth College. No one on this program is working as a paid representative of any of the actual campaigners to fill Chris Collins' seat. And who knows when that next election is, but Governor Cuomo hinting it could be April for a special election. We're back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about what's appropriate, what's effective when it comes to advertising. More companies jumping on this train of advocating for social issues or causes. Obviously Nike with Colin Kaepernick, but also Dove and many more. Does that work for you? We'll talk about it next hour on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and back to your phone calls. Let's go ahead and start with Jack in Greece. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, thanks, Evan. Hey, Evan, I didn't catch your talk right from the beginning, but I think you're looking for what things could be put in place to help resolve issues like we have with Chris Collins. But my thoughts are, one is, it should be a requirement that if you're going to run for a major public office, like a Congress, member of Congress, you should release your taxes so that we can all see if there's any conflict, if there's any financial issues. That's an obvious one in my mind. And I think the other thoughts I have to do with more at the overall party level, the Republican and Democratic parties. Both parties should agree that they're not going to disparage people. They're not going to attack individuals for what they believe, but they're going to try and find out what is the common good and agree upon what's the common good. We're supposed to be, that's the direction we should be trying to move in as a country. We talk today, we see politicians in our parties talk about culture wars, that we won a culture war because we're pro-life, or we want a culture war because we're allowing abortion. But those issues, in my mind, just lead right to the division and feed that division. So we should agree that we're going to move from that.
But let me ask you this, Jack, because I hear what you're saying there, but a couple of things. First of all, when you say we shouldn't attack each other, if I'm running against Mark...
No. I'm saying attack individual voters. We see politicians today attacking individuals.
Okay.
Attack each other. They've got to attack each other on their ideas.
On the ideas.
But not attack people.
Yes.
That, hey, because they voted for somebody that was pro-abortion...
I got you.
Therefore, they're evil. They're mass murderers.
I got
you. That feeds the division that we have today. That idea, that whole idea we hear all the time, where there's a culture war. And oh, we won the culture war because we got our guy in. And I think politicians today shouldn't be running their elections as theater, as rallies, as it should be, let me discuss my ideas. Mm-hmm. But we don't even get to the ideas. All we get to is people, it's like kindergarten, you know, or maybe grammar school level, where we're attacking people and calling them names, and that's the candidate that raises to the top. I think we've got to agree that we want people to, that they can disagree on ideas and policy, but we should be agreeing on facts. You know, it should be what's the common good, what's the best for the country, and we can address how we're gonna meet that. But not, and I like the idea, I think it was Mark Cassini brought up the idea of addressing the funding. That's key also.
Well, Jack, thank you for that. And let's we'll start with Mark here. Culture war. Do you think it divides people in ways that is just sort of aimed at making politics a team sport as opposed to actually accomplishing things?
It's done on purpose for that very reason. They're basically wedge issues that people bring up to get the partisans motivated, the base, to come and vote for
them.
But
what do you do about that? Because they still matter. Social issues really matter. I mean, we can't pretend they don't matter. I don't think Jack is saying that. I think he's saying, though, it just becomes all about sort of personal animus, about which team you're on.
What I'm saying is I don't disagree, but it's being done on purpose. They are wedge issues to draw votes in. That's why it's done. As far as campaign finance disclosure or personal finance disclosure, tax returns, I don't have an issue with that. They do ask for financial disclosures when you run for Congress. I had to disclose what stocks I own, how much, you know, I made, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have an issue either way. That's not a problem for me. I don't disagree with that. But when you start dictating what people should and shouldn't say, you run into that First Amendment issue, as Jen, as an attorney, can tell you. So that's kind of a tough one. My personal, in my campaign, I tried to stay away from any personal attacks, and I didn't run any attack ads, if you'll remember. I tried to stay on the issues.
How about taxes? Release all taxes if you're running for prominent office?
I agree. I mean, there is, for at the state level as well, there's a financial disclosure
that's
very lengthy. I didn't have to release my tax returns, though I would have. And I think that there's a lot of value in that. Because it lets people see not just you, but your spouse, and if you're filing married, what their interests are. Because I think sometimes a lot of people don't see the corruption when it's, you know, my husband's business is doing X, Y, Z, or my father's business is. And what motivates someone isn't always money either. It's about access to power. It's about access to leverage. And I don't know that we can disclose ourselves out of that. I don't know that there is enough disclosure in the world to reveal that about a person.
Okay. Tim Nealon, you want to respond to some of what you heard Jack say, particularly in regards to culture wars and what can be done about that?
Yeah, I understand his position. It actually reminds me of what the progressives tried to do at the turn of the 20th century, because they were upset by the way that the public was responding to rallies and torchlight parades and such. But I have to say, voting was a lot higher in those days. And Trump does get people out at his rallies, in part because politics is political theater. I mean, it really is. It's about communication, and it's not just about cerebral ideas. It's about making options and choices, as, you know, Jen was saying, and you know, Mark was saying. It's people, these social issues really matter to them. Now, it would be nice if we didn't have people disparaging other human beings, and if we could somehow hold people accountable. But again, that's up to the voters to do, and they don't seem to be responding to that. And they do respond to the fear tactics unleashed by both major political parties. So, you know, we could re-engineer the voter somehow, I suppose, but I don't see that happening in my lifetime.
All right, Jen, go ahead first.
Now, a lot of this is about the media, because those rallies garner coverage. And the hot button issues are the ones that get reported on. You know, it's not just about baiting the voters. It's about baiting the media. It's about what's going to get the clicks. And that's a real problem, because what I think we're doing messaging wise now, especially federally, it's not about messaging to individual voters. It's about messaging to the zeitgeist. And what are they going to pick up on? You know, there's been scandal after scandal after scandal for going on 3 years in the White House. And we're picking up now on this Ukraine scandal. Frankly, I'm not sure why this is different than the emoluments, or why this is different than other national security breaches. You know, what was it about this story that made people go, oh, no, this one, I like this one? I think maybe it's a simpler story to tell. But when you're trying to message to hundreds of thousands of people, you need to find something that will be splashy enough for the media to pick up on. And until we get a system that doesn't reward clickbait, I don't know how we're going to get out of that.
Okay, Mark?
All right, Tim, you need to be my straight man here.
Okay.
Why do they run negative ads?
Because they are effective in redefining what that other candidate stands for, particularly if it's a candidate no one really knows. Negative ads would never have worked against Louise Slaughter because people knew her too well.
Right.
But if you've got a candidate nobody knows, you run a negative ad, now suddenly that's the opinion people are going to have. Everything they see after that is going to be affected
by
that.
So they work.
They work.
Yeah.
short version is they work.
I don't like them, and I think it does a disservice, but quite frankly, and people won't like to hear this, but I'm going to tell it like it is. The voters have a responsibility to weed through that stuff, and a lot of times they don't.
But I'll back up Jen and say the media has a responsibility to do at least a little better here, and here's an example. If I see 10 headlines about Donald Trump creates new nickname for the, that's it. Like, juvenile playground nicknames are not news. Now, they might be revelatory of character, but they should not dominate the news cycle more than actual policy that impacts people's lives. And the media gets drunk on that kind of stuff, and it is enough. Let's get back to the phones. Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, getting back to the whole Chris Collins thing, there was plenty of information there, you know, as recently as 2015, that this guy was actually in Congress passing legislation that was, or trying to pass legislation that was going to just benefit him personally. He sponsored a piece of legislation in May of 2015 that was amending the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act with respect to broader application of Bayesian statistics and adaptive trial designs. The press did nothing about this.
Where did you hear about that?
You go to congress.gov and type in HR 2438, and you can find this out.
Okay, but how did you hear about it? Do you read all congressional legislation?
I think that if you have a local representative,
was it reported somewhere?
I don't think it was.
So you found out because you read all congressional legislation?
You're really coming up with that's a red herring argument, because the thing is, the press should be looking more closely. This is something that he actually sponsored.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I'm aware of it because I just found three different stories about it in the news media. So what I'm saying, Robert, is the media can always do better. I don't think that you found that on your own because you read all line-by-line legislation and you're here to let everybody know that the media missed it. I mean, I just Googled it. There's a bunch.
If he does, I might have a job for him.
Yeah. Now, if you want to say that's a red herring and that's I'm being unfair, that part of the story I was aware of because it was reported by other reporters. Can we all do a better job covering this stuff on the substance? Definitely. And Robert, you're right. Especially we should monitor when government does things expressly to benefit themselves, even when it's legal. Legal doesn't have to be ethical. And that's part of, I think, Robert's point here is too, is maybe you rewrite the laws and now it's legal, but it's maybe not ethical. And that's another thing that people struggle with is, what are you writing the laws for? What are you trying to accomplish? So I appreciate that, Robert. And yep, Mark's got a job for you, reading congressional legislation. And we've got a job for you as a reporter. Actually, City Newspaper has a writer's job open, so maybe you'll apply for that. Didn't have time to get through every phone call, but and producer Megan Mack tells me the Democrat and Chronicle even reported that. So, but anyway, let's do this. Let's wrap the program with this here. Whether it's April or not, there's going to be a lot of coverage leading up to this special election. And then We're going to see another election in November. So there's going to be two elections in the next year for this seat. There's going to be a lot said about it. Clearly, there's a lot of lack of trust in government. 15 seconds. Are you an optimist that that's going to change? No?
Yeah. I don't know what the over and under is, but I think I'm going to go with the under. Hopefully, Jen, we relic somebody good.
I wouldn't wake up every day and continue to knock doors if I didn't think I could make change.
Tim, do you think that that the American public is always going to have a mistrust in their own government?
I think there'll be some, but I think we can certainly reduce that by having cleaner government. So I'm an optimist.
I wonder where Eric Massa and Chris Lee are these days. Let's get a panel. Eric Massa, Chris Lee, Chris Collins. Let's do it on Connections. Tell us everything. What else do you have to lose? And I don't mean to be cynical. I would actually love to do that. I want to thank our guests for taking the time. Tim Nealon from Nazareth College. Always good, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Mark Cassini from American Rock Salt and a former many things, including Gatestown supervisor. Nice seeing you. Thank you for
good
being here. And Jen Lunsford, an attorney with Seeger Sorrentino and a candidate in a different district. You might see her knocking on doors if you live in her district. And we will have her and anyone she runs against on this program many times. Thank you for being
here. Thank you.
More Connections coming up.